tell any secrets of the Mau Mau, this oath will kill me. If I am called in the night and refuse to come, this oath will kill me. If I see anyone steal white man's property, I must help him. I must hide what he gives me and say nothing, or this oath will kill me.
The whole system in this country, the economic system, is such that jobs are scarce. Automation is limiting jobs. It's decreasing jobs. And as automation eliminates the job opportunities, legislation will not create job opportunities. All it will do is bring about friction and hostility between the two races.
You see, there will be no progressive revival if black folks are not deeply involved in it.
I will obey all orders of the Mau Mau, or this oath will kill me.
Good evening, friends, comrades, and enemies. This is Pascal Robert, co-host of This Is Revolution podcast, and your host of the Mau Mau Hour, which, of course, is every last Wednesday of the month, where we discuss issues and issues dealing that not only the African diaspora, but politics in general, black political history, not only simply black political history, but left political history as well, and issues dealing with the world within the actual panoply of the role of Africans in the African diaspora in conjunction with the radical left. Tonight, we're talking about a very hot topic. Is Africa in revolutionary fire right now? We're going to have a wonderful guest who is an African expert. Please like and subscribe to our YouTube page, This Is Revolution Podcast. If you are interested to continually be able to watch our actual stream of the Mau Mau Hour and comment in our chat, you have to become a patron until this goes public in the 9 p.m. hour and join us, become a patron, support our show. You'll be contributing to the great work we do here at This Is Revolution Podcast. But if you're unable to do that, like, subscribe to the show, share amongst your friends, and be one of the people who are buying some merch. Get some This Is Revolution Podcast t-shirts, hats, or other forms of accoutrement that might be to your liking. So now we will begin with our episode on what is going on in Africa. For those of you who are not aware, particularly Francophone Africa is in a state of what one would call rebellion against its former colony. We've had tumultuous affairs in Niger. Today, there was a coup d'etat in Gabon, another country, a former French colony. There have been several coup d'etats. So the question we must ask is, what is going on in Francophone Africa? And how exactly does this play into the larger global scene of what is going on in the world between these concepts of multipolarity and African nations appealing to the Russians and the Chinese, some looking very, very happily at the development of the BRICS. So we have our Africa expert, friend of the show, longtime scholar and journalist, Milton Almadi. Milton Almadi is a longtime African scholar and intellectual, editor of Black Star News, and professor at John Jay College. Please welcome with round of applause our friend and Africa expert, Milton Almadi. Brother Milton, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you for hosting me again on your show.
I know it is with pleasure that we have you tonight, because this is going to be a very interesting subject matter and we look forward to your expertise. So let's get down to it. I have some questions here.
Yes.
So, Brother Milton, today in Central Africa's French-speaking Gabon, there was a coup d'etat challenging a political dynasty that goes back to the late 1960s.
Correct.
What are the issues that drove the coup in Gabon?
I think, obviously, they've been in, the soldiers have been inspired by the coups in other countries, beginning primarily in 2020 with Mali. And they've seen that, in spite of international denunciation and a call by the West, a call by the United States, France, by ECOWAS, which is the Regional Economic Organization, Economic Community of West African States, for the people who initiated the coups to reverse it and to surrender power to civilians. In each successive stage, they've seen that the people who carried out the coup have survived. So obviously this provides incentive. You know, after Mali, as you know, we had the coup in both Guinea, Burkina Faso, bringing up to Niger recently. And Niger, there was even a threat, as you recall, by ECOWAS, that if the military did not restore President Bazoum within a week, literally, there would be a military intervention. Of course, that has not materialized. And increasingly, it looks like it may not materialize. Because after the military takeovers, you've seen the scenes of people coming out and celebrating in the streets. So obviously, there is a major contradiction when the call for the military to reverse the coup is coming from Western leaders and organizations that people believe are actually propped by the West, including ECOWAS, even the African Union. A lot of people do not know that the majority of the funding for the African Union, which of course is supposed to be the Pan-African organization to bring about the United States of Africa eventually, the budget is financed by external sources, number one. Number two, the membership of the African Union, of course, the member nation states of African countries, and many of them are authoritarian rulers. So obviously it would be in their interest to immediately also have the call for military takeovers to be reversed. So in addition to getting the inspiration from the previous coups that have occurred, additional to the situation in Gabon is the fact that Ali Bongo, the son of the former autocrat, the late Omar Bongo, declared himself the winner of a disputed election. So I think that was the sparking point. That was the limit. Obviously, the soldiers are part of the population as well. So they feel the discontent. It's not like they live in a separate universe and are not aware of conditions on the streets. I don't think you would overthrow a ruler if you think that the people are not going to support it. And in all the cases that we've seen recently, the people have come out on the streets to support these military takeovers. But that is for Gabon.
Is it fair to say that Bongo, and as well as many of these other heads of state that were kicked out in coups, were neocolonial compradors or collaborators with the French Empire?
The French Empire, the World Bank, and the IMF. And that is actually the essence of the challenge that all these countries face in Africa. A brilliant lecture is out there on YouTube by the late Walter Rodney, one of my great heroes. I adore his teachings tremendously. Of course, how Europe underdeveloped Africa is a Bible for many of us. But one lecture that I highly recommend is called Crisis in the Periphery, Africa and the Caribbean. And Rodney, essentially, to summarize his lecture, he says, yes, formal political independence was good. It was a necessary condition, but not sufficient to create the new post-colonial state in Africa. But what essentially happened was that the struggle literally stopped after formal independence was attained. The leaders, and in his case, he critiques even Kwame Nkrumah. He has many good things to say about Kwame Nkrumah, but he critiques Nkrumah too. And he says the vehicle that galvanized the nationalism, that helped to get rid of the European colonial rulers, did not move further beyond that. They became vessels to sustain the new ruling class in Africa, the comprador, who essentially represent their interests, the things that are most important to them, are very different from the things that are important to the working class, the students, and the peasants and the farmers. He informally includes that in the broad umbrella of working class as well. Who is representing their interests? Certainly not the elite parties whose membership are these Western educated African leaders, right? Which was the case with Kwame Nkrumah as well. And of course, I admire Nkrumah tremendously, one of my heroes as well. But at the same time, I think Rodney had a legitimate criticism. Who was representing the interest of the working class? Where are the working class parties? For the working class, by the working class, and for the working class, with members of the working class in leadership positions. And they don't exist in African countries. They're not there. So you find that the parties that carried on running the state in African countries were reflective of the parties that were ruling in the former colonial empires. So in essence, they had a deal going on. The state was not significantly transformed. Just the managers of the state became different. Of course, there are a few countries that attempted radical transformation, like Tanzania under Julius Nyerere, when he introduced a form of, he called it Ujamaa farming, collectivization of agriculture. And of course, he received a lot of criticism for that. I did not mean for the support of the Scandinavian countries. I don't think Nyerere would have survived long. Nyerere, of course, resisted and refused any deal with the IMF and World Bank. Very wary of their conditionalities. And we know the conditionalities. Remove subsidies on social spending, on education.
Structural adjustment.
Food, fuel, structural adjustment, they call it. In other words, surrender government, your government to the World Bank and IMF.
Surrender, as they did in Haiti, give up your state assets to private actors.
Absolutely.
So
at pennies, by the way, it's a different thing. First of all, you reject it. But if you're forced to sell, how are you selling at pennies? Just think about that. Pennies to multinational corporations that are already very wealthy and don't even need it. And that's what was happening in a lot of African countries. Nyerere, to his credit, it was only after he had retired as president that Tanzania finally had a deal with the IMF and World Bank. So this is a state that became pervasive in many of these African countries. And what they also failed to do was to embrace democracy beyond the rhetoric. And that is also something that Rodney discusses in that same lecture. So you become authoritarian, authoritarianism spreading throughout Africa in the 60s and 70s. And then, if it comes to authoritarianism, who can be better than the military in African countries? So we had that first wave of military takeovers and no essential transformation, really. So once again, after the celebration died, the celebration was over, the questions were the same. How are you going to deliver? How are you going to deliver on employment? How are you going to deliver on expanding the national income? And you can only do that, of course, by transforming the economy. If you're selling primary raw materials to the industrialized countries for cheap and importing manufacturers for high cost, that's something you started doing in 1884. That was what colonization was for at the Berlin Conference. That's what you were doing. So then you have independence in the 1960s. You continue doing that, selling so-called primary commodities or materials and importing manufacturers, meaning each year you become much more impoverished relative to the industrialized countries.
And there's no development.
There's no development, absolutely. The military failed to transform that, to change that. The only attempt, as you know, was under Thomas Sankara in Burkina Faso. When he came to power in 1983, and he preached the mantra, produce what you consume and consume what you produce, self-reliance, had remarkable success. Food self-sufficiency, you know, within 3 years, Burkina Faso was feeding itself. And that's not a minor issue, by the way. You just saw recently several African rulers running to Russia and Ukraine to beg for food. Just think about that. When Africa has been growing food for 5,200 years, just think about that. And now having to run to Ukraine and Russia begging for food. That was the first priority for Sankara. Took that over the table. Education, because ignorance is one of the biggest challenges that we face. So mass education, healthcare, all the way to the rural areas, fighting desertification. In other words, the most important thing was that he taught the Burkinabe, changed the name from Upper Volta to Burkina Faso, that we can actually take control of our lives. We don't need to be dependent. And of course, the third rail was the debt. When he attended the meeting of the Organization of African Unity in Addis Ababa in 1987, in July. And he said, let's collectively renounce the debt so that we can stop paying all the national income that we generate towards servicing the national debt. Debt which some countries inherited at the time of independence. A lot of people don't even know this. So the European rulers were taking debt. And then at independence, they said, oh, by the way, even though we were running the country, there's some bills that need to be paid. Think about that, inherited debt. And then debt incurred by corrupt leaders who embezzled the money, did not put it back in the economy. So he said, why should we pay these types of debts? We would all benefit by starting with a clean slate. But if I do it alone, I will not be alive to attend next year's OAU conference. 3 months later, he was dead, murdered by agent of imperialism, Blaise Compaoré.
Yep.
So now, literally, I'm bringing to the point where we are today. We're seeing a new wave of these military interventions because the state, once again, has failed to deliver. Of course, the military, at some point, many of them went back to the barracks. There was a lot of pressure from social discontent within those countries themselves, saying, you're not delivering, number one, and you are much more violent than the civilians were because you have access to arms. So when we express our discontent, you come down on our heads ruthlessly. You know, people are being killed, people are being tortured, people are being locked up. So the military gave way to a wave of, you know, civilians coming back into power. Now, at the beginning of the the pandemic, the very earliest stages, you know, I did a couple of interviews and I said the pandemic is going to put a lot more pressure on economies that are weak, economies that are dependent on the industrialized countries, the economies where the national income only goes up when the demand for raw materials goes up in the industrialized countries, and the national income collapses when the demand for those raw materials goes down. Now, the pandemic is going to disrupt agriculture. It's going to disrupt tourism, which are essential in many of these countries, meaning the national income is going to collapse significantly. And I said, after the pandemic, many African countries, the governments will not survive. The social discontent will be elevated and they won't have the resources. Even the little resources they had is going to be greatly diminished and many of them will not survive. So that was my reading. And now I think that is factoring in what we are seeing now.
That's a very, very interesting analysis, Brother Milton, because I've never heard yet anyone make the correlation between the political discontent in parts of Africa and their relation to the economic hardship of COVID.
Definitely.
That's a very fascinating analysis that I did not consider myself, and I have not seen anywhere else.
Right, I agree. Actually, I haven't seen it either, but I did two or three interviews, and I said that, and then I made a self-commentary video. In the beginning of the pandemic, I made, you know, self-commentary videos of about 10 minutes, and on one of them, that's exactly what I said. I would be shocked if this was not going to be happening, is what I said.
That's fascinating. Well, listen, you are such a wellspring of knowledge. We have so many more questions, but your insights are so valuable. Let's move on to the next question, please.
Sure.
There have been 9 coups, at least 9 coups in the past 3 years in former French colonies: Mali, Guinea, Burkina Faso, Chad, Niger, Tunisia, and now Gabon. Can you explain the factors that led to such political turmoil and how it is related to the neo-colonial relationship of France and its African Francophone former colonies? In other words, you gave a very elaborate and eloquent explanation of the neo-colonial process that basically fettered the ability of independence overall in Africa.
Yep.
From what I've researched and read, there were some certain nuances to the way in which the French implemented their neo-colonial model that even more effectively disadvantaged their former African Francophone colonies. Can you elaborate a bit on those practices, if you can?
Absolutely. Well, I will start with the mindset, first of all. The whole process of so-called assimilation, which was part of the French colonial policy, that they would civilize the African natives and they would be able to become black French, refined Frenchmen. They would be able to elevate themselves above their barbaric and African primitive past. So that was something uniquely French. The British did not do that with their colonial, quote-unquote, subjects in the country they dominated in East Africa, in South Africa, in Southern Africa, and then, of course, the few in West Africa as well, like, you know, Ghana and other countries that were British colonies. So the French actually, and it's worked actually, said that if they were able to infect the minds of the Africans to get them to aspire to be black Frenchmen.
Milton, let me interrupt you for a second. As a Haitian, which is a former French colony, I basically have stated this. I even said it on Facebook. There's no worse colonized Negro
Yes.
The Francophone colonized Negro.
Yes, absolutely. So therefore, if you believe in that, then of course, what are you fighting? How can you fight against what you want to become, which is a civilized Black African French man, right? So that actually, I think, held the lid intact for a very long time in the former French colonies. That's one part of it, the psychological, intellectual colonization, which did not subside at all or ease after formal independence. Then number two, the French had their former colonies on economic lockdown by maintaining control of their currencies. If external countries control your currency, how can you argue that you're politically independent? It's not possible. The currency is what people use for transactions domestically. The currency is what you use for your engagement with the rest of the world. So they created the CFA currency, which was used by most of those former French colonies. And it is tied to the central bank in France. They had to maintain their reserves in the French central bank. And the French central bank was responsible for transactions with their reserves. In other words, it was actually adding to the French national treasury. They were responsible for investing, meaning the French were making decisions on how their savings, their national savings, you could see it like a national saving, like me having you deposit your savings and giving you control to your savings account. I decide on what to buy in terms of what to invest it in.
And of course, you can take whatever fees you want and put it in.
Take whatever fees you want. If it makes a profit, fine. If it collapses, you know, too bad. You have no decision over that, meaning you have no decision over the fluctuation in the value of your currency as well. Think about that. Obviously, they have that arrangement because it benefits the French national treasury. Number one. Number two, it keeps French control over your national economy.
Well, let's talk about how they got there. The story of course, you know, Sékou Touré in Guinea, and how when he was declaring independence, the French literally said, if you want to be physically independent, fine. They went in and took back all of the infrastructure,
right,
that they had in the country and left the country barren.
Thank you for bringing that up. Because, of course, Sékou Touré stood out as a hero at that time when France, you know, under de Gaulle, so-called gave them a referendum. You could decide whether you want to go your way independently, total independent, or you could have some level of autonomy, but remain a part of the broader French community of countries. And Sékou Touré, union leader, activist, dynamic speaker, mobilized, and supposedly got Guinea to vote no, and yes to total independence, no to continued colonization, whatever fancy format you wanted to substitute for it. And I say supposedly only Guinea, because we need to go back and actually study carefully. France actually manipulated the outcome of this election in many of those countries. So up to now, we don't even know if it was indeed only Guinea, right? Mm-hmm. But as you pointed out, wanted to set an example to the other African countries and sent their people to rip up even electric cords,
yes,
light bulbs, destroying roads that they'd built, bridges. Now, who really does that? Except the true barbarian, actually, does that.
Well, let me tell you why this is. One of the reasons why I find the French treatment of Francophone Africa fascinating, because it harkens back to the way France reacted to Haitian independence.
Yes.
They refused to accept the fact that Haiti was independent. And as you know, the consequence of what happened in 1825, they forced, well, with the combination of, unfortunately, a surrender by one of our tragic figures, Boyer, what became eventually $25 billion indemnity.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. That is a perfect comparison and analysis. This is a perfect comparison. So
they forced Haiti to pay reparations to France.
Yes, which ended not a very long time ago, by the
1947.
Right, very recent in historical terms. And of course, Haiti is still paying the consequence of that. So Haiti never had a time to consolidate its independence.
No.
The same thing with the West African countries. They never had a time to consolidate their independence. And look at Niger as one example. That same vote that you talked about in 1958. So each of the former colonies, the emerging political class, could campaign against it or campaign for it. To say no to being a part of that so-called community or to go out on their own. In Niger, there were two leaders. One campaign, yes, I want to maintain this relationship and stay within the community. And the other, his cousin, campaigned no against it. And there were many reports that France actually manipulated the outcome to benefit the leader who campaigned yes to maintain our semi-colonial relationship. And the leader who voted no, his political party was subsequently banned right before independence in 1960. And he himself driven into exile. And many of his party supporters forced to join his cousin's party who had voted yes. And other parties were banned. This is all under French direction, right? So they imposed a one-party state from the beginning of so-called independence in 1960 up to 1974, when this leader was overthrown in a military coup. So now when France talks about a democratically elected leader in Niger and calling for the military to concede power, the hypocrisy is beyond measure, knowing that France itself was responsible for making sure that democratic tradition never took root in Niger by imposing a one-party state from the get-go, because that was their man, so to speak, in Niger.
Incredible, incredible. No, this is all, there's so much to cover here. There's so much to cover. So, brother Milton, there's another question I have for you.
Yes.
Niger is high in the uranium that provides for large segments of French power and electricity, while Niger has no 24-hour electricity. Right. How does such imbalances relate to the neocolonial relationship France has with its former colonies in Africa? And how did such realities motivate the coup in Niger that is causing great consternation to the French?
Okay, very good. Because this is what is now the essence of the conversation. In European corporate media, you may still be reading about this demand for the military to yield power, you know, ECOWAS. But the larger conversation that Africans are having exactly the question that you just posed. How is it possible that a country that is the seventh largest producer of uranium, how is it a country that is essentially supplying France with all the uranium it needs? And not only France, the other EU countries, by the way. How is it that national income per capita per head, going by World Bank standards, is less than $600, while in France it's $40,000+? How is that possible? How is it possible that the literacy rate is under 20% after all these years of so-called independence from 1960? And France has been exploiting the uranium, by the way, since 1958, even before independence. So that has not changed. And of course, people are asking that question. And if, as we speak right now, the new military administration has banned uranium exports to France. And they're using the denunciation of European economic imperialism in Africa as the main narrative right now. And that is really being very effective in mobilizing young Africans, where you have countries where we have unemployment rates up to 60 or 70%. And they're using that argument that it's because these previous leaders have allowed this type of exploitation of our countries to go on. And that is how they're able to mobilize so much support right now. So what may have started as a possible internal beef between General Chiang, the leader of the Presidential Guard, and President Bazoum has now gone beyond even the general himself. Even if he wanted to backtrack, he would have no choice. I would not be surprised if younger officers, because he's in his 60s, in most of the other countries, the people that are being have come to power are much younger, 35, I think, in the case of Burkina Faso with Traoré, early 40s in the case of Goïta in Mali. So, in fact, I would not be surprised if we see further transition in Niger, younger officers coming into play. But so far, the General Chiang is responding to the young people that are coming out to the streets. And that's why I say, under these conditions, I don't see how it's going to be possible for the France/ECOWAS intervention to take place in Niger. And I think when you have now this new coup now in Gabon, that even changes the equation much more dramatically. Are you going to go into Gabon as well? How can you go in Niger and not go into Gabon, which, of course, has had a coup as well? So I think the longer it takes and the more dynamics change on the ground, it's going to be much more difficult for intervention. Intervention is not the main narrative right now. Now the conversation is, what are we going to do about the exploitation? There's never been this type of conversation on such a scale before. And what that's what unique about these military coups in African countries. Rarely did it address the issue of the country being exploited. It was always, oh, the leader is corrupt, you know, which is true. The leader is embezzled. The leader recruits people only from his ethnic groups. But it's never been a question of the leader is allowing our country to be exploited by the former colonial powers. So this is a very new dynamic in this conversation.
Are you concerned by the fact that, according to numbers, the presence of the French military in West Africa is allegedly larger than both Niger, Burkina Faso, and even Mali combined? According to what I understand, the numbers of French presence in West Africa is rather extensive. How do you surmise that affects your calculation on their capacity to invade these countries, if necessary, and neutralize them?
All right. If it's a matter of conventional warfare, I think they would have an advantage, perhaps not so much in the numerical superiority of the number of soldiers, but in the technology. I think they would have much more sophisticated equipment. I think, you know, they have their own drones. And if it came to a situation like that, obviously the United States would have to make a decision. Are they going to support a NATO ally, or are they going to sit on the sidelines? The United States would probably sit on the sidelines because I think they have their own, you know, their own interest at the same time. So far, the U.S. has not even officially called the coup in Niger a coup, because it would automatically trigger some laws. The U.S. would not be able to continue cooperating or working with the authorities in Niger. That is why the U.S. ambassador has not been asked to leave. It is the French ambassador who's been asked to leave Niger. So, but in terms of technology, the drones, the aircraft, of course, the anti-aircraft missiles, the tank, the armored personnel carriers. But how are you going to fight in countries where you are not wanted?
Right. So your calculation,
in themselves,
that your calculation is that because this is not simply a war against African militaries, but a public relations war against populations Absolutely. Who basically despise the French.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They would resort to
guerrilla warfare,
and eventually they would be driven out. And of course, their economic interests would also become targeted, not only in Niger, but most likely throughout West Africa, because these conversations are now being connected. As you recall, when ECOWAS made that threat, both Mali and Burkina Faso said they would come to militarily support Niger's military. And they went ahead and even signed agreements that would authorize that. Realistically, of course, it would still be difficult because the French, you know, that part of the terrain is very open space. You can target convoys and strike them with missiles. So it would come at a very high cost. But that has, as I said, other repercussions as well. It would become a public relations disaster, not only limited to West Africa, but in the entire African continent, and the African diaspora as well, globally.
Excellent. Well, let's continue, because you're so information rich here. Brother Milton, can you explain to our audience what is ECOWAS and what role do they have in the affairs of Niger and these other countries that want to distance themselves from France?
Okay, very good. So ECOWAS is the Economic Community of West African States. And in the same light as in the Organization of African Unity, in the same spirit of the African Union, officially designed to promote economic cooperation and economic integration, and with the hope that that would also bring sort of harmonization of the politics in the region. So the thought is that, you know, so you have the South African Development Cooperation, SADC country, SADC, and then in East Africa, you have the East African Community. The thought being that perhaps if integration could be accomplished on a regional basis, that at the end of the day, it would allow the entire integration of the African continent. And presumably, there would be no need for ECOWAS at some point. There would be no need for SADC at some point in the future. There would be no need for the East African Community either, because now you would have a United States of Africa. So theoretically, it actually makes sense. Logically, it makes sense. But as I pointed out earlier, it's very difficult to maintain your Pan-African perspective and ideals if much of the operation is being funded by external actors who, of course, do not want to see the United States of Africa.
Well, let me ask you a very direct question. Is it fair to say that, much like CARICOM in the Caribbean, that ECOWAS has become a basic puppet of Western NATO allies and the EU?
Of course, absolutely. In fact, it's not any secret. If you read all the reporting is that if ECOWAS were to intervene, it would be financed by France, because none of the ECOWAS countries wants to dip into their budget. So if France is going to be paying for the military operation, then of course it's a French operation, which has been, you know, seconded, right? Option to ECOWAS to carry out. And that's how clear cut it becomes. And it's not difficult to imagine why ECOWAS would be like this, because the leaders, you have to look at the individual countries, right, that make up the membership of ECOWAS, just like you have to look at the individual leaders that make up the membership of the African Union. That is why Thomas Sankara was very dangerous, because he did not want to be the same type of, you know, comprador class selling out the African agenda. And that's why he was a danger. He was a danger in that if the spirit of Thomas Sankara was to infect just two or three more African leaders and it started taking root, then it would change the nature of ECOWAS, it would change the nature of the African Union. And that is what they will not allow to happen.
Would you agree that Thomas Sankara was probably the greatest leader in post-colonial Africa?
Well, I would rank him very highly. But of course, I think Nkrumah was right up there as well. I think Julius Nyerere was right up there in rank. In fact, Thomas Sankara learned from both Nkrumah and from Julius Nyerere, in the sense that renounced the debt, in the sense that he never signed any deal with the IMF and World Bank. And a lot of the Pan-African agenda that he espoused was directly from Nkrumah's neo-colonialism, the last stage of imperialism.
In yes. fact,
even the food independence, if you go to, I don't know which edition this is, in a paperback edition, on page 29, you will find Nkrumah writing about the need for food independence. So let's not surrender food independence to external sources. If we do, that is the end of it. We will never be able to have independence if we cannot feed our own people. And he went on elaborating on how they should come up with all these schemes to ensure food independence.
I had a follow-up question that we already kind of covered, which was, there are reports that France is willing to cooperate with ECOWAS countries in military cooperation against Niger. Do you see a legitimate possibility that France go to war in Africa over recent events like Niger, Burkina Faso, Mali, and Gabon?
They could, but at a tremendous cost. I think Gabon changes the equation a little bit, because now you've lost one other, quote unquote, close ally, you see? And in fact, this talk of the intervention may have also precipitated this military takeover. We don't know yet. They haven't made enough statements since they just took power hours ago, literally. So we don't know. But I would not be surprised if, in fact, that could have been one of the primary motivations, you know, because for him to survive, he needs to be like this with France. So if there was going to be an intervention, you need the manpower, right? I would not be surprised if that was one of the conditions. We will support you, even though we know you stole this election, the recent election. We know you stole the past elections as well. But if you provide the troops we need as part of this ECOWAS operation, that's fine. We'll support you. And obviously, these leaders in the military, they would have to become aware of something like that. So that could be it. I'm speculating, but I would not be shocked if that happens to be one of those reasons. So now you lose Gabon. You have Ivory Coast. So literally the willing participants are shrinking. Of course, the leader of ECOWAS, the current president of ECOWAS, is the president of Nigeria, Tinubu, which of course is the military and political and economic powerhouse of the region. But he's also getting a lot of resistance from the senators in the Nigerian Senate. Reportedly, many of them oppose approving the intervention. I think they would need to give their approval. I think he can deploy under certain special circumstances. I don't know if this would qualify. I think it would have to do with something with national security. Then he could deploy without authorization from the Senate. But this kind of intervention, I don't see how it threatens Nigeria's national security. So he could risk being impeached if there are enough senators who oppose it and he goes ahead and does it unilaterally. You know, he could be impeached and he could be out of office. So that's the risk also that you face. So increasingly, as it prolongs, it goes longer, it looks like it's going to look much more difficult that there will be. But nothing is impossible to desperate colonialists, right? Nothing is possible. They're not going to just sit back and watch their empire disappear. So they might be reckless enough to convince one or two of these countries to provide the manpower. And, you know, France will provide all the equipment and all the money. And they might still go. But I think that will just open a whole Pandora's box with more attacks against French interests. I think it would be very difficult for them to continue exploiting uranium and any other resources from the other African countries.
We have a good question here from one of our chat participants. If all the coup governments stand, can they cooperate long term, or will intertensions create conflict between them?
Okay, that's a very good question. I think let's go back to the Mali coup by Assimi Goïta in 2020 initially. That coup was not precipitated because Goïta was sitting one day and he said, well, you know what? I've been thinking a lot about a fellow soldier, Sankara, years ago in the 1980s, who was doing so many good things for his country as a Pan-African nationalist. I'm feeling the energy of Sankara, so let me also take over power. No. The main motivating factor was the punishing war against the so-called jihadist, who, by the way, became armed with the most sophisticated weapons, better than the ones that the Mali military had, because the French state and NATO and the United States destroyed Libya. And all those sophisticated weapons became available, empowering all these militant groups, whatever you want to refer them as, to the extent that they're literally defeating the military in Mali, and the soldiers took their discontent against the civilian governments. The civilian government's incompetence, inability to fight the war. Well, the question is, how are they going to fight it if the soldiers themselves can't fight it because they have so much sophisticated weapon? So that was the initial spark. At the time of that coup, though, there was a lot, because the student unions, organizations, the trade unions are very well organized in Mali at a very high level. So they were already having street protests and demonstrations and strikes, and they were about to bring down the government on social issues, not only on the war itself, but on economic issues, social issues, delivering their failure to deliver, right? So they might have had an authentic revolution in Mali. The military stepped in, because they were facing that war and they saw the situation that was chaotic, they took advantage of it. And they might have hijacked that revolution, but people kept coming back on the streets. And now France was putting pressure on the military. Go back to the barracks, you know, because military are a bit more unpredictable. They want to deal with that puppet civilian president that had been overthrown. But the students don't want that puppet to come back. So the students and the trade unions lend their support to this military. The military had no option but to embrace the spirit of the revolution. Whether that had been their intention from the get-go, which it was not actually, now they had no choice. So now this same template is now being used in other countries. So when you had the coup in Burkina Faso, they were following the rhetoric that was being used in Mali. Anti-French imperialism, kicking out the French embassy, kicking out the French military, which is what Mali did. And of course, inviting the Russians and the Wagner group to give them that military support that they were losing by kicking out the French. So Burkina Faso followed that same model, and now you're seeing Niger, the new military leadership there, also replicating that same model, embracing the denouncing French imperialism, exploitation, kicking them out, inviting the Russians, and then mobilizing support of the masses to support their coup. So the question is, will it go all the way, or will some of them say, well, you know what, I kind of like being on top as, you know, quote unquote, president of this country? Or will we still push that social agenda that some of the trade union, the students, the progressive actually want to be implemented? I think the jury is still out on that. I think they may have no choice, because if they don't, then the population will withdraw their support, and the colonialists will be able to come back and impose their own puppets once again.
Fascinating. So I have another question. This is a relative to kind of what you were saying. One of the things that is often seen amongst the current cadre of anti-imperialist African leaders is a strong contempt for NATO and Western nations and a great appreciation for the role of Russia in Africa. Do you think the belief that multipolarity will offer a reprieve from Western imperialism is what drives this affection?
Yes.
Russia in Africa and other parts of the global South? And do you think it's an effective strategy?
The answer is yes. Is it effective? Well, you know, Russia is not the Soviet Union anymore. Russia is not it's not as powerful as it seemed to be when it was the Soviet Union.
It's not working on a moral ideology.
Exactly. So there's a difference between, you know, saying I'm going to get support from Russia in the 1970s, right? Against, you know, pressure from the West, as opposed to today. It's a much smaller economic base because of, obviously, when the Federation sort of split up, it lost, you know, Ukraine, for example, right? Resources there, and then the food basket, you know. So that took a lot away from the former Soviet state. So, you know, the short answer is Russia's not able to provide the kind of support that the Soviet Union was able to do. So I don't know if a lot of these military leaders who may not be that experienced have bought on to that, right? But diplomatically and politically, there's an advantage of embracing, you know, the enemy of the West at this time, the enemy of NATO. So in that sense, politically, of course, it plays into that. But a much more powerful potential ally, of course, would be China. China has the capacity to support them economically. I think the only reason why they're running to Russia and not to China, whose economy is now approaching the size of the United States, right? Which is China's economy is, you know, maybe 8 to 10 times larger than Russia's, right? They're not running to Russia to China because Russia still has the Wagner Group, which was providing the military resources that many of these countries need. And China has not been playing in that type of politics in Africa since its engagement with Africa started in the post-colonial era. Only, of course, in special cases where they were supporting the liberation armies by training them, by providing them weapons when they were fighting the armed struggle against the colonial regimes in what was then Rhodesia, Angola, Mozambique, Namibia. So that's where China was actively supporting military activities in African countries.
Listen, let me ask you a question. Are you optimistic about multipolarity as a concept, as well as expansion of the BRICS nations? Do you see that as a plus for Africa?
Absolutely. 100%, without a doubt. What BRICS? Because, you know, the biggest obstacle to Africa's economic transformation are the structural adjustment programs that have kept African countries in a colonial type of relationship with the industrialized countries. After more than 60 years of so-called independence, not a single African country has been able to industrialize. Not a single African country has economically developed. Think about it. So I tell people all the time, the purpose of the World Bank, even though its official name is the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, that is not the case when it comes to Africa. Show me one success story. It's not there. The purpose is to lend and keep them dependent on these loans, just to exist and continue exporting raw materials, but not to develop. And it makes sense. The major shareholder is the United States. Why would the United States want to develop another competitor who would sell manufactured goods just like China does? China is a competitor with the United States, but China did not develop its industries through World Bank loans. Of course not.
Are you not concerned that Russia and China will offer the same kind of exploitative relationship?
Of course. I love that question. In fact, Samir Amin, also one of my, you know, favorite political economists, you know, of all time, discusses that in a lecture. And the lecture is called Africa's Industrialization Challenge. And that's also on YouTube by Samir Amin. And he says it is up to the African leaders to make their demands, to have their plans. If you're only asking for money from China, they'll give you as much as you want. Even personally, they could put $100 million in your personal account if you want, so long as you give them access to the resources. But on the other hand, if you have clever demands, saying in addition to some money, I want technology transfer so that I am also able to start using these raw materials within my own country to produce manufactured goods. That's part one. Number two, these countries cannot operate as these individual, you know, people used to say Balkanized countries, but even the Balkanized countries, you know, the former Balkans are more organized now, so we need to come up with a better term. But these tiny split up nations, they cannot operate on the global scale alone. And that's why the regional organization are actually very important. But they need to be regional organizations that are feeding the interest of the African people, not being manipulated by outsiders to carry out their own neo-colonial rule. And by the way, once again, neo-colonialism, the last stage of imperialism, Nkrumah has a blueprint for what kind of economic activities regional African countries should do, focus on this, you know, industry, let this other region focus on this industry. You know, he had it well mapped out. So the plan is there.
Excellent. Well, Milton, we are over an hour. I want to thank you so much for the very information-rich conversation you brought to our show today. We've got to have you on again to talk in more detail about various aspects about African politics, how it affects the African diaspora, particularly in the United States. Yeah. We're thinking about having a show on our next Mau Mau or another show on the viability of Pan-Africanism within the African diaspora. So we would definitely invite you as well as a guest. But for now, thank you again. And we look forward to seeing you again, Brother Milton.
I look forward. Stay strong. Stay strong.
Peace. Well, thank you again for watching this episode of the Mau Mau Hour on This Is Revolution podcast. Look forward to seeing you on our next episode tomorrow with Jason. And I think I might be on that show as well. We've been over an hour, and thank you again. Watch the next Mile Mile Hour, the end, the last Friday of the month, next month. Bye-bye.
If I tell any secrets of the Mau Mau, this oath will kill me. If I am called in the night and refuse to come, this oath will kill me. If I see anyone steal white man's property, I must help him. I must hide what he gives me and say nothing, or this oath will kill me.
The whole system in this country, the economic system, is such that jobs are scarce. Automation is limiting jobs. It's decreasing jobs. And as automation eliminates the job opportunities, legislation will not create job opportunities. All it will do is bring about friction and hostility between the two races.
You see, there will be no progressive revival if black folks are not deeply involved in it.
I will obey all orders of the Mau Mau, or this oath will kill me.